So we were in the middle of introducing proof patterns. We had case distinctions. We had contradictions, if and only if. And now we come to the quantifiers. So how do you deal with quantifiers? And first, what is called introductions. So how do you prove a statement? How do you introduce a quantified statement? So here's the rule, not the rule, the proof template for proving a universally quantified formula for all x, p of x. And if you now do proof, then implicitly something will happen. Namely, the system will say, okay, you want to prove something that's universally quantified, so I assume you want to prove it, you want to prove the thing inside the p of x for some arbitrary but fixed x. And so to reflect that, the text that you have to write looks like this. You fix x, so you fix some arbitrary local variable, so this is just a comment. And then you show p of x, and then of course you do have to give the proof still, but this is the template. And so from here onwards, you've gotten rid of the quantifier, and you're just focusing on the formula underneath the quantifier, and you have created a local variable that acts as this arbitrary but fixed value. And you don't have to call it x, you could call it anything, but I've just called it x here for familiarity. For the existential quantifier, it looks like this. If you want to prove an existentially quantified formula, and you start your proof with proof without a minus, so by telling the system, okay, you can go ahead and do what you think is a good first step, then the system will say, okay, this is an existentially quantified formula. If you try to prove that, I assume you will want to prove a particular instance of this formula that you want to give a witness for the x. So the system expects you to show p of some witness term. So this is an arbitrary term. I don't know what it will be in that particular case. In the proof QED, you have some proof leading up to showing p with some term that you've invented. And then, of course, you still need to get the proof. So these are the two ways of dealing with existential and universal quantifiers when you try to show a formula that contains them. The dual situation is if you have a formula, as an assumption, say, that contains a quantifier at the outermost level, what do you do with that assumption, that fact? And for the existential quantifier, it's more tricky, and there's a specific language construct to deal with them, and that's the obtain. So it's called an elimination because you're starting from a formula that has the existential on the outside and you want to eliminate it and you want to get to the formula inside. And this is the template. So assume you have some, you've proved that there exists an x such that p of x, so there's a proof missing here. There should be a proof text here. And then from that proof or from that fact, you want to say, okay, well, if there exists some x such that p of x, let's get hold of that x. Let's introduce some name for it so that we can refer to it. Because here it's just a local bound variable. From the outside, you can't look into the formula. But here with this step, you can. You say, okay, then we can actually create such an x which has the property p of x. And this is the template. The step from here to here is logically trivial, and so BLAST can do this. You should also give it a name P, because you may want to refer to this property of X further down. So in the rest of the proof, you've got two new things. You have a local variable X, which is implicitly fixed like the fix in the universal quantifier introduction. And you've got a new fact that p of x holds for that x. And I think that should be virtually everything. You could also have multiple the quantified variables, they exist, X, Y, Z, that works just as well. Here's an example, and this example will also explain one of the steps that I didn't go into in the proof of Cantor's theorem. So if you remember, in the proof of Cantor's theorem, we were trying to prove that such a function from A to A set cannot be surjective. And we assume it is surjective and derive a contradiction from it. And this was as far as we got. There exists a little A such that the image of A under F must be this diagonal set, the set of all X, such that X is not a set of, not an element of F of X. And in the original proof that I showed you, from that I would just, in one step by blast, derive a contradiction. Now it may not be clear why is this statement contradictory. Let's look at it in more detail. Now with the obtain, we can look at it in more detail. We can say, okay, well then we can obtain some A that has this property. And now you can ask yourself the question, okay, if we've got such an A, then is A in this set or is it not in that set? And so we can put it differently. If these two sets are the same, then our little a must belong to this set on the left, if and only if it belongs to this set on the right. And this is what we're expressing in the next line. So a is on the set, a is in the set on the left. Well, when is an element in this set? Well, if and only if a is not an element of f of a. So that's what we write here. And when is it on the right? Well, if it's in that right. So now the contradiction stares you in the face. You can't have that an element is in the set if and only if it's not in the set. So this obtain allowed you to do a little deduction that made things clearer. Because that's part of the trick of why this is contradictory is that you have to choose this exists, you have to take this A and ask yourself, is it in the set or is it not in the set? And then, yeah, that's trivial. So this is a simple example of using the obtain. And these are two more rules for dealing with sets. We will get back to the quantifiers in a moment. Two sets are equal if they are subsets of each other. This is the template. If you just say show the equality of two sets by proof, then the system will assume you're trying to show this and this. And so you have two subproofs separated by next. And how do you show that one set is contained in another set? This is the template for it. Something is A is contained in B. If known, well, The proof template is you fix some element X, you assume it's on the left in the A, and then you have to show that it's in the right set, the B. So that's the standard way of proving that either one set is contained in another or two sets are equal. And now we go to the little exercise. And the exercise will actually deal not with the sets, but with these introduction and elimination patterns for the quantifiers. And the obtain, yeah. Right, there we are. So this is the little exercise. Let's make it one bigger. This is a standard exercise from logic. You assume that there exists a single x such that for all y, p of x, y. So this x is related to everything via p. And then you claim that for everything, there exists an x that is related to it. Well, clearly, if there's one thing that's related to everything, then, of course, to everything, there is something that's related to it, namely this one thing. And now we have to write down this proof. And let's assume it looks like this. And now you'll have to tell me what we should be doing inside. Which pattern applies? Do we want to reason from an assumption forward, or do we want to reason backward from what we're trying to prove? And what should we be writing now? Yep.
I would try to prove by contradiction.
That's too complicated. It only involves the rules that the templates that we have just seen, just the quantifiers. Yes?
I mean, we have the assumption that there exists an X, so we could just obtain such an X.
Right. We will do that in a moment, indeed, thank you. But something has already happened, and we should react to that. We wrote something down, namely proof, and that may have a side effect. And if you look at the output, you will see that we are no longer trying to prove this. And if you look at the template, you will also see that what's happening when you try to prove a universally quantified statement. So what should we be doing here? We should be writing something down. This is pattern matching. There's a statement of the form that we're trying to show something, and then we write a proof, and then we have to write fix, and we have to write show again. I was hoping that you'd understood the system so far. So what do we have to write? Okay, I'll dictate it for you. Fix X, show what? Yeah, the thing underneath the universal quantifier. Thank you. So this is just our reaction to the fact that the system implicitly assumes, it's not a show X, fix X was a bad choice, fix Y, and now, yeah, we're getting, yes, that one again. So I think last time we just needed to. And we have some proof here, which we have to fill in. Let's just write sorry. And then we can at least see that the system accepts the proof in interactive mode. So everything is consistent. We just need to refine the sorry. So all we've done so far is that we've used implicitly the introduction pattern for the universal quantifier. So we're now here, and I suggest to continue at this point. You could also open a proof block here, but that gets us into a little technical problem later on, so I'm already suggesting what to do. And now we can come up with your idea. So how would we write this? If you go back to the templates, you want to reason forward from an assumption that is existentially quantified. So this is where the obtain comes in. So we don't have a have. So the statement that we're starting from is not something we have obtained with have, but it's something that we already have as an assumption. And then we obtain the quantified variable and continue reasoning from that. So it would be from the assumptions. We haven't given the assumptions any names, but there's a standard name, ASSEMS, that is this, the list of all the assumptions, and there's only one, so we can just say from ASSEMS, obtain an X where what? Yep. That's it. And now I will actually change the names A to show you that they can be changed inside the proof, and B, because otherwise it gets very confusing. There's just X and Y, and you tend to stop. Okay, so this is, oh, sorry, where? By blast. Okay. And we should give this a name. Let's call it just, I don't know, star, which is a legal name. So let me call this one not Y, but let me call it B. Fix B, and then, of course, we have to modify it here. Oops. So I've just, in proving this statement, I'm not calling the variable Y, I'm calling it B. And in this statement, I don't obtain an X. It's called X here, but that's just a local name. I'm choosing a different one. I'm calling it A. And then, of course, we have to change it here as well. Okay. Now, let's refine the show. We're trying to show an existential statement. And let's just write it as a proof block, proof QED. And then let's remind ourselves, what does such a proof have to look like if you're trying to prove an existential statement? So then we're here, oops, in the lower part of the window, of the slide. So we're inside of the proof block. We will have to show the P with some particular witness. Oops. So let's just write that down. Show. It is called P actually here. P of B and something. Which something do you suggest we should put there?
The A.
The A. The A, which we do have in our context. I'm claiming we can show P of AB. Okay. So if we can show P of AB, then the whole proof is finished. So let's do it. Let's do it very slowly. Of course, how do we show the P of AB? Naturally, we show it from the fact that for all Y, P of A and this Y. So you can just say from star show this, and that's a trivial logical step because you're taking a universal quantified formula and you're just replacing the universal quantifier by some specific value, and that's not a logically difficult step, so BLAST can do this. And that that completes the proof. And you can now see that we've used four different kinds of reasoning steps, namely two elimination steps where we start from a quantified formula and remove the quantifier, and two introduction steps where we have an unquantified formula and we introduce the quantified formula. So here is the forward step where we removed the existential quantifier and introduced a new name for that existential quantifier into our context. Then from here, from the star, we also removed the universal quantifier. That's what happened here. And BLAST could do this. That's a no-brainer. And on the other hand, where do we introduce quantifiers? One is here, where we show a existentially quantified statement, and we show it inside from an unquantified statement where we just have replaced the X by some witness term. In our case, the witness is the A. And finally, where there should be, oh yes, finally, here we are proving an existentially quantified statement in this proof step here, and that means we have to introduce a name for the universally quantified variable, and then inside we show the unquantified statement where the for all y has disappeared. So that's why this is in logic courses a much loved deduction, because it exemplifies all four kinds of reasoning steps about quantifiers. Questions about what's happened here?
If we have a formula of multiple of the same quantifier, can we tell things or tell it somehow which we want for which we want?
No. You have to take them in the order that they're there. So it may work. So let me try a variation just to see if this works. X, let's call this X and X prime. And now we want to eliminate just the inner X prime. So from assumptions obtain A prime, where the outer, the existential X is still there. Well, this is, let me make it even like this. X, X prime, Y. I don't want to trivialize it. Let's ignore the conclusion. I'm just making it type correct. Let's call this Z. Okay, so it's type correct. Now here we're trying to obtain the inner X prime. It's called it A prime, and it should now be P of X A prime Y. And that actually works. So BLAST is clever enough that it can do that. On the other hand, if here you have two universal quantifiers, then if you do proof, you really have to peel them off one by one. Any other questions? So BLAST can usually do more than just this simple one quantifier at a time, you can always try and be a bit more creative there. But if it's one of these simple steps where BLAST isn't involved, like you're trying to prove a universally quantified statement and you just do proof, or existentially just do proof, then it only does this one quantifier. So those were the quantifiers. And now something that's quite important for this course, chains of equations and inequations. So this is what you will find in textbook proof, where you have long deductions with equations and inequations, starting from some term T1, which is equal to T2. And on the side, you usually write because and some justification. And then this is equal to T3, again with some justification. And finally, this is equal to Tn. And this embodies a proof of T1 is equal to Tn, with informal justifications on the side. How does that look in Isabel? Quite similar, but with a bit more syntactic sugar. So you really write half, then the first equality, and a proof. But in order to tell the system, I now want to combine this with the second equality, you write also between the two equalities, and then half, and then you write this. And this is really literally three dots. And the three dots stand for the previous T2. Just as in a text, normally you don't write anything here, you just write equals to T3. Here you have to write something because the syntax enforces it. And in order to spare you writing T2 again, I forgot to exchange batteries. To spare you having to write T2 again, you can use dot, dot, dot to refer to the previous end of the equation chain. And then you just have further also halves until you reach the end with the Tn. But that isn't, then you should, you must really write down what you have proved one more time. So you write, finally show T1 equals Tn, and then you just need as a justification a dot. So that's a particular pattern that helps you to stay honest. So you explicitly state at the very end, what have I proved now? Because sometimes it can happen you wrote down, made a mistake in T1 or in the intermediate TI, and in the end it's good to remind the reader, well, what have we really proved, and state that again. So this is the pattern that you should be using if you have chains of equations and inequations. Questions about that pattern? Okay. So the also and the finally is something that you haven't seen yet, and same as the dot as a proof method, but otherwise it's a standard sequence of proof steps. And you don't have to use equality all the time. You can also use less than or equal or less than. Here's an example, a random example, just with T1 and just with T's in it. And so you have in the first line, you have less than sign, and then you have an equality, and then further down you have a less than or equal. And if you chain all of that together, you get a less than sign because you had at least one less than inside. And you really, that's the one thing that is fixed. You have to do the inequation chain from the smaller to the larger term. If you turn it around, it won't work like this. So remember that with inequations, starting with the smaller term, working towards the bigger term. But otherwise, it's like an equation chain. the dot dot dot, let me just jump over that. That's just some internal which I don't want to discuss. So let's go directly to an example and an exercise. And let me backtrack here. This was just for demo purposes that I changed things. Let me just undo all everything. We're back in a right. So here we have a simple proof of an inequality that x squared plus y squared minus 2xy is greater or equal 0, and I'm fixing the type of everything involved to be a real number. By just fixing 0 to be a real number, then of course everything else has to be a real number as well. And what does the proof look like? You start out by saying, okay, this is certainly true, that the square of something is greater or equal 0, and SIMP happens to be able to prove that. That's not obvious, but it's one of the rewrite rules in the system that the square is greater or equal 0. And then you expand the term on the right, the x minus y squared, and you write in the next line, we have dot, dot, dot is equal to x squared plus y squared minus 2xy. So you're just unfolding up. You're just multiplying out the square. And remember, the 2 is not a successor term, so the system will not automatically be able to use the definition of the power function on this, because the power function is defined by recursion over successors. So you have to use this numeral EQSUC rule, which tells the system to make every numeral a successor term. And then once the 2 here has become a successor term, then the exponentiation can be unfolded. And you also use algebra SIMPs, because this is a little bit of basic high school algebra, and if you didn't include this, then the proof would fail, and we can actually look at what happens if that step fails. Let me remove all of this, and now it turns red, and so now that's the point where you look at the output, what's going on, why, and then it says here it failed to finish a proof, namely the proof that x minus y times x minus y is equal to this. And then you can see, oh yeah, it's failed to multiply out the use the distributivity, and yes, distributivity is part of this algebra simps, so I should be using algebra simps because it helps to simplify or multiply out terms to do with addition and multiplication. So the output window will show you the error message, and you can then react to it by adding more rewrite rules to your simplification call. In our case, the right was algebra simps. So whenever you're dealing with real numbers, then it's usually a good idea to use at least algebra simps, and if there's division there, also field simps to hopefully deal with it automatically. If it still can't do it automatically, then you have to think harder. And now comes the last line. So we have these two steps. We start out with zero. We have that it's less or equal this term. In the next line, we have that this term, so the dot, dot, dot refers to the previous line. And if you look at it, if you go to this line, it actually says explicitly the goal that you have is this one, so it has replaced the dot, dot, dot by the x minus y squared. So that's just a writing simplification. In the actual goal that you're trying to prove, it shows you exactly the term from the previous line, the x minus y squared. And on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, of course, you see the term that you've written down. That's here. And so you can combine these two steps by saying, finally, show the first term is less or equal than the last term. And in fact, we don't need to write this down like this. Instead of writing all of this by hand, what could we use? There's built-in shorthand in the system. Yeah. Yes. Because that refers to the main statement that you're currently trying to prove, and that is still this one here. Why is it still this one here? Because your proof, you started with proof minus, saying don't do anything, just leave things alone, I'll do it myself. So that's important. And in fact, if you hadn't done the minus, I think the system may have complained. It doesn't know what to do with a less than or equal. There's no automatic step to prove, or an automatic start step to prove a less than or equal. You explicitly say, well, don't even try. And now we can use the same kind of proof principles in a different proof. This is the incomplete proof, and I would like you to suggest to me what we should be doing. So the start, the pattern is the same. You're trying to prove some inequality here, namely that x minus y squared is less or equal x squared minus y squared if x is greater or equal y and if y is greater than 0. And I'm also saying prove minus. There's nothing that should be done automatically. And in the end, I want to show a thesis. And I'm already starting on a chain of equations by saying, okay, what we can do is we can multiply this out, the x minus y squared. And we do this by using the numeral EQSUC and the algebra simps. And then we get this equality. And the question is, how should we continue from this right-hand side? How should we work from this right-hand side towards this right-hand side? So it's clear that we should be doing something like this, but what else? Now this hasn't got anything to do with Isabel. That's just a mathematics question. How do you complete this proof? Yes. To 2xy is greater than 0, but what does, how does that help us? Yeah, the problem is we have a plus here, and we want to make it into a minus, and we do subtract something here. So, what's the mathematics behind it? And I'm suggesting a single step that does something with this form, with this term here. Leave the rest alone, just concentrate on that term and replace it by something else. Based on the assumption, yes?
Because we know that x is greater or equal than y, we can say that 2x times y is smaller or equal than 2y squared.
Yes. Right, that's the key idea. So this is less than or equal? Oops.
No, greater.
You're saying we're getting it towards a smaller term?
No, it's minus, it's less or
equal. Yeah, because we're subtracting a smaller value, so the whole thing becomes bigger. And then we just copy the first part. And then we do this very simple manipulation of saying, okay, x is greater than y, so if we replace x by y, this becomes a smaller term, and so therefore if we subtract a smaller term, it becomes bigger. So let me just do this very simply, 2 times y, right? And then we say, by simp, that doesn't cut it. So, of course, we need to tell the simplifier that we're using this assumption here, right? So we say, using assumptions 1. That still doesn't do it. Well, maybe it's got something to do with we also need algebra simps, because it is a little bit of algebra, so let's add that one in as well. No. No, it doesn't like it. So there's a little bit missing here. A little bit of information is needed in this step, which I have explicitly not given. And that's nothing to do with Isabel. That's, again, just pure mathematics. High school mathematics. Yeah.
X is also greater than 0 because y.
It will then be sufficient to put in that y is greater equal 0 is greater than 0, because if y is negative, then this step just is not correct. You're replacing the x here by a smaller value, but if the thing that you're multiplying it with is negative, then that will actually have the opposite effect of what you hope. So you do need both assumptions. Y has to be greater than 0, and then it'll work. And possibly even the algebra simps is unnecessary, but I think it will be necessary. Let's see. No, it had nothing to do with that. It was just the missing assumption. And now we have completed our chain of equations. Well, no, we haven't quite. We need one more step. But now it's completely obvious. If you subtract 2yy from y squared, of course, you get minus y squared. Sorry. Let me just copy this. No, this. So the plus y squared is replaced by a minus y squared, and this disappears. And now I think we have another example where we need first the system to expand this y, the 2, into a successor term, and then it can multiply things out. So I assume this will do the job. Yes, it worked. And this doesn't quite work. Remember, if you look back to the slides, then we have to have this finally in front of it. That finally indicates, please take this equation chain that that precedes this step and use it to prove the final step. So we have to write, finally show thesis, and that is now just the dot stands for failed to finish proof.
I think you need to add the also.
Ah, thank you. I forgot the also. And you can actually see what's going on. If you click on the finally, it says picking this. So this indicates to you what is the actual property that it's using to show your thesis. And now it is really the property that you expected it to be. If we leave out the alsos, then you will see that when you look at the finally, oh, yeah, so of course it's even complaining, no calculation yet. So that's a meaningful error message. And that indicates you've forgotten the alsos. Yeah. So questions about this proof? Then let's go back to the slides. Just a few words on streamlining proofs. This isn't absolutely necessary, but it's helpful. It makes your proof shorter and more readable and also easier to write. Pattern matching and quotations. This avoids a lot of duplication. So remember, this is part of one of the templates that we saw, and it's the template how to prove an if and only if, by proving both directions. And in proving both directions, you have to once assume formula one and show formula two, and once assume formula two and show formula one. But that means you have to write both formulas twice again, and you can avoid that by, and this is the new part, by writing this behind your statement. So behind any statement of a formula, you can write in parentheses, is left if and only if. Is something, is some pattern, and in our case, the pattern is an if and only if with an open left and right hand side, or rather a variable for the left and the right hand side. So the result of this pattern here is that the question mark L will be bound to formula one, and question mark R will be bound to formula two. So L and R in the rest of the text are just shorthands for formula one and formula two. So they're really just two characters which the system will expand to the whole text, formula one and to formula two. And now the rest of the pattern looks much simpler. You're not duplicating anything. And if you later on decide to change something in formula one, it'll automatically propagate to the rest of the proof because you haven't duplicated formula one, you've always used question mark L and question mark R. So the exact text here is irrelevant. It's just the important thing is that there was a similar text earlier on which had, instead of L, formula one, and instead of R, everywhere formula two. And now you just use the abbreviations. Right. That explains why there was only one answer to what I could have written the thesis, because I hadn't introduced it yet, but you knew about it. Great. So this is another shorthand. So in this example, I'm using this system introduced shorthand question mark thesis, What does that stand for? It stands for the thing that you were asked or that you need to show at that point. And so implicitly, thesis is set up here, but you don't need to say that. Every show implicitly defines thesis, so this show up here defines this thesis, and the show doesn't get destroyed by the proof because we have a proof minus, so the proof minus says, don't do anything, just keep on trying to prove what I originally asked to prove, namely the formula. So that means at this point it's still the same formula, and indeed the minus means we don't have, we're still proving the same thing. So this can be useful if you have a longer formula which you don't want to duplicate. You can also introduce by yourself in a proof an abbreviation of some term, question mark T. I mean, can have any name, they all have to start with question marks, that's the point. And then you introduce that as an abbreviation for some big term, and then later on you can use in your formulas that you write down, you can use the question mark T, and it will automatically get replaced by this term here. So the proof state doesn't become any smaller, but the text that you write down to create the proof state, that becomes smaller by introducing the abbreviation. So you don't have to do anything to expand the abbreviation. The question mark T, after passing, it will immediately get replaced by some big term. And this is a very convenient way of referring to short, small facts that you have proved somewhere else or that you've assumed. normally, what you would be doing, you're writing something like this. You have some proved, some intermediate fact that x is greater than 0, and you're giving it a name, x0, and then you later on say, from x0. But for the reader, it's always hard to read such text, because what was x0? If it's not 2 lines above, but 20 lines above, then you have to search for it. Oh, it's for x greater than 0. Why can't we just write from x greater than 0? Well, you can. This is what you have to write. So at this point, up here you do not introduce a name, x0, and down here you don't refer to the name, but you refer to the actual formula. And the syntactic convention is that you then need to enclose this in back quotes to tell the system this is a reference to a previously proved formula, and back quotes are back ticks. And then you don't need to give this thing up here a name. And the fact that I don't have any spaces in there is irrelevant. Yep.
What's the difference to the swagger jackets we used to for
The difference to what?
The swagger jackets.
It's the same thing. So there are currently two syntaxes in the system, and this is the old syntax, and you can also use the open and close delimiters, and then they work as well. You don't need the back quotes. I'm quite fond of them, but yeah. Any other questions? So I don't think I want to demo this. There's nothing special about it. So the slides should suffice. And yes, top-down proof development. We should do that one. This is a simple example of how to prove something slowly in a top-down manner that I want to go through with you. So this is the lemma that I'm trying to prove. In your homework, there's a similar kind of lemma. So this one says there exists lists y's and z's such that this list x's. So this is you would normally probably read it for all x's, but you can drop out the most universal quantifiers. For all x's, there exist two lists y's and z's such that x's is the append of y's and z's, and either they have the same length or their length differs by 1. And how do you prove that? You can prove it by induction, and in the homework you have to prove it in the induction, but here you don't have to. There's a much simpler way to prove it. Any suggestions from the audience how to prove this? Just informally without me. Isabel? Yeah.
Oh, this either length of 2k or k plus 1.
Right. Yeah. So let's do a case distinction on the length of the list. And that's what I want to go through with you. Right here we have our example. So we replace the, so this is the thing that you just saw on the slide. And so now we have proof QED, and we say we want to do a proof by cases. And then you go back to the pattern, and luckily, well, no, actually I don't, the system is already suggesting what, there's something in blue here. If you click on the proof, it comes up with a proof outline, but I don't actually like that outline. It doesn't quite work either. So in this case, I'll write it myself. So there were two cases, assume one and show the thesis. Next, whoops, that's not what I, there should be a, sorry. And assume the negation. Of the same thing, and then again show thesis. So this is the complete template of a proof by cases, where you just want to once assume one property and once assume the negation of that property. And the property that we are interested in is it has an even length or an odd length. And so let me state it like this, because I know it's going to work like this. There are various ways of stating it, like with 2k. I'm going to state it like this. There exists an n such that the length of x's equals n plus n. I think 2 times n would work just as well, but let's do it like this. Okay, and here, of course, we would assume the negation of that one, and we need to put the quantifier in parentheses for syntactic reasons. And now the proof skeleton is, has been accepted, and now we have to reason, we have to fill in the missing bits here. And the central idea is, if you have an even length list, then of course you can explicitly name these two witnesses, the Y's and the Z's, because we have functions on lists that allow you to take and drop. So there are basic functions take and drop on lists, and we can use them to construct witnesses for Y's and Z's. So let me do this by hand, and let me introduce let question mark Y's, so I'm just using a suggestive name here. So this is supposed to be the witness for the Y's, and what should that be? So we want a witness here that satisfies this statement. Yeah?
Take n x's.
Oh, yeah, take n, but I, of course I was a bit too quick. We need for the n first. So how do we get our hands on the n? Because now at the moment the n is just a local existentially quantified variable. Yeah. So then obtain n where length of x is equals n plus n. And that's just last. Okay, now we can use that n, and it's the first part of the list is take n from axis, and of course the second part of the list will be drop the first n. Well, and now we can already do another top-down proof. Have what? Namely, we can claim that we can prove not the existentially quantified statement, but we can prove the statement inside with our given witnesses. So we claim that axis is equal to question mark y's append question mark z's. And, well, let's keep it simpler. Let's first prove that this part is true. The other part, let's drop that because it might make the statement too complicated to prove automatically, and I'm trying to prove it automatically in a moment. So this should be true in the case that we're in, that they should have the same length. So let's not worry about proving it yet, and let's just see if from this statement the next one follows. Then we can say, well, then show thesis, and let's just try blast, because that seems like a pretty simple logical conclusion from the line above to the to this line up here. You just need to know a little bit about OR and existential quantifiers, and I think BLAST should be able to do this. And indeed, that works. So all that's left now is this part, and here we can try and be lazy and just ask Sledgehammer to do it, because there's a big background library on lists, so it should be possible to prove this. It did find a proof. Yep. Okay. Yeah, that's a pretty simple one. And here it's quoting a previously proved fact, namely the fact up here from the obtain that the length of axis is n plus n, and here it is not using the back quotes, so I think I should really adapt to the latest syntax and not use the back quotes anymore. The system is using these pointed brackets, that has the same effect as what I talked about earlier. We don't need to give this fact a name, we can just quote it by its value, so to speak. And that's the complete proof. I'm not going to go and do the other part as well. That's dual. And of course, we were helped here because the simplifier already knows a lot about take and drop and can automatically deduce the relevant facts here. So that was just an attempt to show you how I would develop this proof and try and do it in a stepwise manner, introduce abbreviations, leave things out that before I prove them, I just state them with sorry to get the proof outline right and then refine the proof outline. Yeah. Yes, so when automation fails, you have to split your proof up into smaller steps. You can, that's one way of doing it, or you can explore things with apply. So if you have such a situation, you want to prove something using something, then you can write this, apply minus. That will just have the effect of making the using facts part of your proof state, and then you can continue with applies, with auto or whatever. And at the end, you either just write done, or you try and be neat and convert this unstructured proof script back into a structured proof. So if you are ever in the situation that you feel like you want to explore the situation with or apply, this is the thing to do, apply minus, in case there are any incoming facts, and then start off with maybe apply auto to see why things are difficult. And The last thing I want to introduce is a little convenience, again, local lemmas. So instead of doing everything on the global level, you can also write implicative statements locally, and this is the syntax for it. You can write have B, but under some conditions, if the assumption A1 to AM hold for all values X1 to XN. So this, on the top level, you would write this with assumes this one, or fixes this, assumes this, and shows the B. Here inside it's a slightly different syntax, but it has the same effect that you're trying to prove it universally for all the X's, and you're assuming these assumptions, and you're trying to prove the B, and you'd better give the assumptions a name, because inside the proof here, you want to refer to them, so you name them. And the thing that you get out of it is not just this implication here, but it's this implication where you have replaced these fixed variables by these question mark variables, so that in later proof steps you can use this proved fact here with arbitrary values for the xi. So this is something that you may see occasionally, but unless you have a complicated situation, it's probably not so relevant. And finally, a few words on the correspondence between the proof text that you write and the proof state that you see in the output window, in the state window. And so what you write is proof and then possibly some method, or the system automatically applies some method if you don't write anything yourself. And then you can look at the output window and you'll see that this will be your proof state, and therefore you know what are you allowed to assume, what you have to fix, and what you have to prove. And in principle, such a subgoal corresponds to fixing all the variables that are up here, assuming all the assumptions in square brackets or in iterated arrows, and showing the B on the right. But in practice, of course, you don't obtain such a proof state in one step, but you obtain it in several steps. So you don't typically fix all the x's at once, because you just generally introduce, say, one x at a time, and you introduce one assumption at a time. And so not all of these need to be assumed at one fixed place, but you will generally have a nested proof which assumes first maybe just x1 and assumes a1 and then fixes and assumes more things. But this is the general correspondence. This is what you're trying to prove in the system shows you, and this is what you should be writing roughly. And of course, if you have multiple subgoals, you have to separate the proof of each subgoal from the next case. And now I want to introduce you to the to conclude for today, introduce you to structured proofs by cases and induction. And let's jump right in and do a proof by cases. So this is in a separate file that's called ESA induction demo. And let's go to the very beginning. And let's just look at this quite explicit case distinction. And now we're talking about case distinctions on data types, not case distinctions on Boolean formulas, true or not true, but case distinctions on things like lists and trees, where we're asking ourselves, is it the empty list or the list that contains a starting element and then a tail? And this is precisely what we're writing down here. So the lemma statement is just trivial, it's not so interesting, but how do we prove it? By cases over x's. So x's is a variable that occurs in the lemma statement, and it's of type list. And if you say cases over a variable of type list, then you'll get two cases. And in the first case, you're allowed to assume that x's is empty, and then you show thesis. Remember that in a proof by cases, what you are proving does not change. So you still have to prove that original statement. What changes are the assumptions. So here you, in the first In this first line here, you are allowed to assume that X is empty. And in the second line, it's not that X is non-empty, but more concretely, X is of this form Y cons Ys for local Y and Ys. So you have, in your proof by cases, you get over a data type, you get lots of cases that are always of the form the thing that you're doing the case distinction over is equal of this form or is equal to this form. And when I say form, it means, well, it's some term of the form y cons y's where these are arbitrary, are fixed values that we don't know what they are, but we know that y's is of this form. And then you deduce theses from it. So the important point is really these two assumes here and the fixes. And this is, if you had a proof by cases on natural numbers, you would have two different cases. You would once assume that the natural number is zero, and once you would assume that the natural number is successor of some arbitrary fixed natural number y or n. So it's always the case distinction over all the constructors. But you can write things a bit more compactly. And that's shown in the next proof. And this proof is identical to the previous one, except you write it down differently. So here you have explicitly written, I assume, and then you see what was assumed. And again, here I assume, and you explicitly fix some variables. Now, in the next version of the proof, let me just remove this stuff because it's cluttering the text. This is really the same proof, but it's using system-provided abbreviations. So instead of writing assume, as up here, now you can see both, you say, this is the case nil. That means I am in the case where X is nil. So this statement, case nil, is really just a short way of saying assume X is the empty list. And here you have case cons Y Ys. This line here is a short form of this line here. And why can we write such a short version? Because the system knows what we're doing. The system says, okay, you're doing a case distinction on lists. I go away, I look at all the different cases that there are. Okay, and the cases are named just like the constructors in your data type of lists. And the constructor was called nil and was called cons. So you really have to use these ASCII names here. You can't write down here cases and then write open square bracket, close square bracket. That's just syntactic sugar. You have to go back to the basic names here. That's the one thing you have to be aware of. And you can't write here case y cons y's. You really have to use the ASCII name of the constructor. So in the worst case, you have to go back to your data type and remind yourself what that is. Except that the system actually provides a template here. So now at this point, the template is quite useful. And if we click on this, or even just hover over the proof, this is what the template gives you. And it's pretty much the same template that we used, except that we've called the variables not A and list, but we called that Y and Ys. But otherwise, it's the same template that we have used in here. So this case construct in a proof by cases simply is an abbreviation mechanism for writing down explicitly by hand fixes and assumes for each case. So questions about the correspondence between these two proofs, the handwritten one and the templated one, or the one that uses the case construct. Then I think we go back to the slides, which just summarize this, what I just showed you. So in general, a case analysis over a data type means you have some data type T, which is defined by a number of constructors. And then if you say proof by cases over some term, this does not have to be a variable. It can be an arbitrary term. Then the system provided abbreviation mechanism with the cases that if you write case C1, so you don't have to look at the constructors in the order that they were declared, it doesn't matter, but I started with C1, and then you write down some list of variables that correspond to the arguments of C1, and then inside you can use the variable names, but what's more, you can also use these assumptions here. And this is something I didn't show you, namely that what when you write this, it's an abbreviation for this. It fixes the variables in here. It assumes that the term that we're doing the case distinction over is of this form, the constructor applied to the variables. And it also gives this assumption a name, CI. We didn't need that name in the examples. If we go back to the example, here, case nil actually produces an assumption that this stands for then show, so that means this assumption of the from the previous line is directly used in the next proof step and same here. So therefore we didn't need the names, but the names are there. So if after the case or anywhere you say what is the name of the theorem called what is the theorem called nil, then the system will answer in the output window, it's the theorem X is equals the empty list. So the name of the constructor is also used to give a name to the assumption. And similarly here, if you ask yourself after the cons, what is the theorem called cons, then it shows you it's the theorem that X is equal to this cons construction. So there's a heavy overloading going on here that the name cons stands both for a constructor of a data type. It also stands in this case for a theorem, namely the name of the assumption. And that's just for convenience that both have been conflated. And of course this theorem cons only exists locally. If you ask afterwards theorem cons, that's not a known theorem. Well, it happens to be a known theorem, but it's a something very strange. So for bigger proofs, you have to use those names because it's not always as simple as this that you can use the assumption and directly use it in the next proof step. But in general, the constructor here is the name also of this assumption. And so you can later on refer not just to the names of the variables, but you can also refer to the CI, the name of the constructor, and you are given the assumption that the term is equal to this form. Those were the case distinctions. Something quite similar works for inductions. And let's first look at an example. This is the proof that the sum of the first n natural numbers, so here it's the sum, this is just notation for the set, an interval, all the natural numbers between 0 and n, and the sigma in front of it is a summation operation, and that should be n times n plus 1 diff 2. And here we are using the abbreviation mechanism saying this is what we're trying to prove and please give this statement the name question mark P and it depends on N. And then we say proof by induction on N. And then in the base case we show question mark P of 0. So the result will be this formula here where the N has been replaced by 0 and that can be just shown by SIMP. And in the next step, this is the induction step, we fix some arbitrary n, we assume that P of n holds, and then we show P of successor of n. So this is the standard template that you get taught in an undergraduate class how to do induction on natural numbers, except that you wouldn't be shown successor of n, you would be shown n plus 1. But you introduce a new name N, you assume that P holds for that name, and then you have to show that P also holds for the name plus one. So here it worked quite well because everything could be done by simp, and I'm not interested in the individual steps, I'm just interested in the structure here of how to write down the induction. So here you're doing the induction just using the abbreviation mechanism with a P and then explicitly writing down P of N and P of N plus 1. Now we can do the same trick as with the case distinctions. I'm not going into the, if you want to see the proof in more detail, here is another version of the same proof with the equalities shown in detail. But here I want to show the implicit version using the system provided cases and case constructions. So this is the same proof but written down slightly differently. So instead of introducing afterwards here is question mark P, you use the system provided mechanisms, and then you say after the induction here, you say K0 and K sub of N separated by next, and that's all you need to write, just like in the case distinctions, except that here's the one example of where you can actually use the symbolic name zero. You don't have to, I mean, that is also the ASCII name of that constructor. But the question mark, in the list case, you can't write this one. Case, empty list. You really have to write nil. But here for the zero, it works. You can just write zero. And here you write successor of n. So that looks so pretty much like a case distinction, but it's more than a case distinction because you have to prove different things in the different branches. So you don't have to write down what you have to prove. You can just write down show question mark case. So this is another addition to our armory. So it's a system defined abbreviation, and it stands for the formula that you have to prove in that case, because that formula changes. If you go back to the explicit version, then you can see it. In one case, you have to show P of zero, and you have to show P of sac of n, and this uniform question mark case notation instructs the system to insert the right formula there. So the system will expand here the formula to this statement with n replaced by zero, and here it'll be this statement with n replaced by a successor of n. And we can see that if we actually look at the proof state. So this is where the proof state comes in helpful. For start, of course, the template with the cases, that is also produced by the system. And if you hover over the proof statement, then there's the outline. You can insert it automatically by clicking on it, and then it will insert that text. I'm slightly surprised why. Oh, right. Because I had highlighted the whole thing, the insertion overwrote everything. So let's do it again. If you now click on this, it'll just insert it after the proof here, and you would need to refine the sorries. But I'll just undo this and go back to our own proof. So if you now want to see what am I really proving, you can go down to the show case. And then in the proof state window, you will see what you're trying to prove. And if you go here to thus case, you will also see what you're trying to prove. So here in the second, in the induction step, it says explicitly, I'm using this And this is the induction hypothesis, that it holds for n, and this is your goal, that you now have to prove that the same statement holds for successor of n. So you can, by clicking on parts of the text, you can always look at, oh, well, what do I really have to show at this point if you can't figure it out yourself? And yes, and otherwise it's like the case distinctions. So. So this is the situation for structural induction for natural numbers. You have to show some property P of n. You do it by induction on n. You write once K0, once you write K successor of n, where the n is an arbitrary name. You don't have to use the name that's in the induction in the original statement. And then you have two cases to show, and the system will insert the right statement, namely here it'll be P of 0, and here it'll be P of successor of n, and out of this case comes the assumption that you are allowed to assume P of n. And so this is really what the system is doing. And when you say this, the system introduces the case and says, okay, case is equal to P of 0. If you do case of sac of n, the system introduces an n, assumes that P holds for n, calls that assumption the same name as the statement, as the constructor, and it also introduces the abbreviation question mark case. Well, in this case, please show P of successor of n. So you can see all of that when you go to the, like, if you go there, then you will see that case has been expanded to whatever the statement is with successor of n. Things become a bit more tricky if you're trying to prove an implicative statement. Then the system does more things automatically for you. So let's just, for simplicity, assume you have a single assumption, A of n, and you have a conclusion, P of n. You can write things like that and then prove them by induction on n. And there'll be two cases, the case 0 and the case successor of n, and you have to show a case. So everything looks like before. The tricky thing is, what are the assumptions in each place? And what the system does, it says, okay, you're doing an induction on n, but let's just look at the base case. In the base case, I have to show A of 0 applies P of 0. And then the system says, okay, let's already assume A of 0. So you don't have to prove an implicative statement, but you have to prove just P of 0, and you are given the assumption A of 0. So that means here in the case 0, where you normally would expect there are no assumptions, because you're just in the base case, you do have an assumption, namely A of 0. Your assumption where n has been replaced by 0, and what you have to prove is just the conclusion of your implicative statement, the P of 0. So this double arrow, really, if you use that, then the system does more work for you automatically, in that it assumes the left-hand side of the implication, and you just have to prove the right-hand side. Here it's a bit more complicated, because now what you have is, normally you would say your assumption is just A of n implies P of n, and what you have to prove is A of sac of n implies P of sac of n. So this should be something that comes out of your case. Or rather, yeah, there's the. Remember, all the assumptions are given the name of the constructor. So under the name SAC, you should find this assumption. And question mark case should be this, that you're trying to prove this implication. But the system does more. The system says, oh, you're trying to prove the implication. Why don't I already assume the left part? So in fact, you get two assumptions here. You also get the assumption A of sac of n and that disappears from here, and what you're trying to prove is just the P of sac of n. So the system does a bit automatically, and that's what I'm trying to explain here in that slide, that because the case you're proving is in fact an implication, it just moves the left-hand side of the implication to your assumptions and leaves you with the right-hand side. So it simplifies the system, simplifies the proof a little bit. So this is only happens if you have an implication here. If you have just an atomic statement like the one that we had earlier, which was an equation, then you don't notice this. Yeah, this is the general situation. And here the slide explains that there are even more precise naming schemes. This slide generalizes the situation that we just saw, and in fact it says these two things are given different names. Here the name SAC, let's go back to the previous slide, the name SAC stands for both of them. So you have SAC of 1 is this one and SAC of 2 is this one, but they have more precise names. This is the actual induction hypothesis, so this one is also available under the name sac.ih, and this one is available under the name sac.premise, because these are the premises of your implicative statement. Can I help with something? So this is what this slide here tells us. This is the actual induction hypothesis that it holds for n, and these are the premises because we're proving an implicative statement. And if you just take C, the name of the constructor, then you get both of them, like successor stands for both of them. If you want to be more precise, you can also use these more refined names. That makes it, may make the proof simpler. Yes, and whether you choose one style or the other of writing down your proofs doesn't matter. And I would like to conclude with computation induction, because there are some little some tricks there, some specialities that you need to know about. So far, our inductions were always inductions on a variable of a data type, but now we look at a different kind of induction where we induct on the computation of a function, a terminating function, and here is a simple example. So this is the diff2 function, which divides the natural number by 2 and has three defining equations for the base cases 0 and 1 and for the case sac of n. And never mind the exact definitions, it doesn't matter. Just look at the left-hand sides. We have three non-overlapping patterns. And then you try to prove some lemma, never mind what the lemma is, and you say, I want to do induction on n, but please use the induction rule that comes out of the definition here. And so that means in this additional syntax with case, you have to give these cases names. You don't have, the system gives the cases names. The cases that we saw so far were the names of the constructor of the data type. What are the names here? Here the names are simply equation number 1, equation number 2, equation number 3, and so that's why they are numbered. And so this case 1 will refer to the first equation, which refers to the situation where you're just looking at 0, n is 0, and you don't have any induction hypotheses. Case 2 is the second equation, so that's the equation where n is 1, and again you don't have any induction hypotheses because there are no recursive calls. That's the one-to-one correspondence. And here in case 3, you have to give a name to the variable, because you're now looking at the situation where your argument is of the form successor of n. So if we now go here to case 3, what do we get? What is the the induction hypothesis that we have for the third case? Well, the induction hypothesis is that what we're trying to prove holds for n, and what we have to prove that it also holds for n plus 2. So this is the induction principle that comes out of this function definition. You prove something for 0, you prove it for 1, and you prove it for n plus 2, assuming that it already holds for n. And this is the formula that you would get here. You would get the induction hypothesis in the case 3 of n. And indeed, if we look at that formula, maybe by hovering over case, no, I don't think that works. Let's just go behind it and look at the output. Yes, what we get is this is 2 times div n is less or equal n. That's exactly the lemma statement. So that's the induction hypothesis for n. And if we move further down and we say, finally show case, then we get the statement with n replaced by n plus 2, that it also holds that 2 times div 2 of n plus 2 is less or equal n plus 2. So that is the statement of the lemma up here on the top, but with n replaced by n plus 2. So it works like in a normal induction. It's just that the cases are named differently. The cases are named by the numbers of the equation in which case you currently are. And I think you can give those equations names, and then probably, I'm not sure if that helps. Let me call this equation E. Can you then say case E? No, you can't. Right. So it really is fixed to be this numbering according to the order of the equations. And there's one little thing that I... here's a note on naming scheme. I'm sorry, I have to go over time today because I want to finish this. If you can refer in the proof to something like, you can ask, what is the theorem 3? And indeed, it'll tell you that's the theorem. But if you now want to use this more refined naming scheme and say, oh, I want the induction hypothesis because that might be 3, might be multiple things, that doesn't work for lexical reasons. So that is not going to work. You have to put quotes around it, then it works. That's in general, if you have fishy names, then it's always a good idea to put quotes around them, and that's more likely to make them work. And the final thing I want to explain is that you have to be a bit careful here. Let me remove all of this. It's irrelevant. Yep. We look at another recursive function definition and another computation induction. And now this is kind of funny. You have the definition up there, and then you do an induction on the induction rule that comes out of the definition of your set function. So never mind what the set function does exactly. We have had it before. But the funny thing is, there are 2 equations here, but suddenly you have 3 cases, and two of the cases have funny names, 2_1 and 2_2. What's going on here? Why do we have this non-standard situation here? Why aren't they just called 1 and 2, but why do we get 2-1 and 2-2? What's funny about the function definition? There's something a little bit different from the previous function definition. What's the difference?
Yes. Has X's has cases.
Yeah. So here, the second equation is in fact not really one equation, it's two equations. Implicitly it says if x is not of this form up here, and so that means x can be either empty or a singleton list. And that's what the system actually does. Implicitly, it will replace, I explained that a few weeks ago, it will replace the definition that you wrote by its own non-overlapping definition. And if you look at the simplification rules that come out of the SEP definition, then you will see this. You'll see the first line is your original line, and the second two equations, they are system-generated equations obtained by specializing your last equation, because your last equation isn't really an equation. That doesn't hold for all x's. It only holds for x's that are not of the previous form, and that gets compiled into this. And similarly, the induction principle will have funny names in it, but it's not a problem because the system actually generates the template for you. So if you go on proof, it shows the template, and you just need to click on it and paste it in, and then do proof each of the cases in the template. So if you use the system-generated templates for induction, then you're always on the safe side. It'll generate things correctly, and it'll also put the... that's it. And this is really all I wanted to say. You will have to familiarize yourself with inductions on the example sheet. So this is just another abbreviation, another explanation of what I already said. And this is all just documenting what I said. And the new example sheet that will come out, exercise sheet today that will come out today, is dedicated to ESA and will also contain initial small proofs by induction and proofs by chaining equations. And I hope you will slowly familiarize yourself with the language. It takes some time to get used to it, and if you have questions, just asking why doesn't this syntax work and what should I write, feel free to use Piazza for such questions. Questions like, which variable should I induct on? Well, that's a heuristic, and why don't you try them all? And you'll see some of them will work and others won't work. So that's not the kind of question I'm likely to answer. Others, if you really have some questions with the mechanics of the system, by all means, we'd like to help on that. Okay, that's the end for today. Thank you for going over time, and see you next week.